Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We will begin today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 4. Is it ready? Okay. Chris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 4 creates a credit against income taxes for each new full-time position created. Currently, the bill has the blank for the credit that limits the total amount of credits to be issued to $10 million. And the bill specifies criteria to qualify, and those include that the position must be filled between July 1, 2009 and December 31, 2009, remain filled for at least 12 consecutive months, and result in a net increase in the number of full-time equivalent positions for the taxpayer as compared to the level that they had on June 1, 2009. It directs the Department of Revenue to establish a certification process and applies to tax year 2010.
Okay, in committee, we have the profound honor today to have our Senate President here to advocate for Senate Bill 4 and Mr. Atkinson as well. Did you two want to come together? No? Let's hang on here. Showtime. Welcome, Mr. President. Please don't forget to identify for yourself for the record.
This was your idea. Chair Burdick, members of the Finance Revenue Committee of the Senate, Senator Hass, Senator Telfer, Senator Morris, and Senator Rosenbaum. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive in Salem, and I'm a state senator from District 11. I'm here today to testify in support of SB 4. The last several years, I've spoken to a business acquaintance I have, actually a former state legislator I used to serve with, fairly successful, to say the least, in business way over in Eastern Oregon. And we always talk when I get together with them about many things. One of them is economics and incentives and things like that for small businesses, particularly in rural areas, but also in general. And I particularly was talking to him recently because of the unemployment situation in the state, as well as the current economy, as well as the whole issue of incentives to create employment. And we do not have a lot of money to put into programs like Senate Bill 4 sponsors, and I recognize that. And it's caused me a lot of pain and suffering on my side of the aisle for even coming up with the idea, because it would involve tax dollars going in an area when we already have a shortage of tax dollars. But we eventually decided to introduce it. It's a business incentive tax credit, as I understand it. As again, I don't do business like some of you do, and I fully admit that to you. And it would give employers a tax credit when they hire. It started out, he said, for hiring summer students. It would be like they just could not resist this. This is a very irresistible thing in terms of at least getting students. At the time, we discussed it years ago, hired in the summer months, if you allowed this to happen. So I asked my staff to look into this and look at other possibilities in view of where we are right now, as well as the shortage of tax dollars. They looked at a variety of options from around the state and throughout the country, and this is what they came up with in working with legislative revenue. Allows the business to take a non-refundable tax credit from any employee for any employee they hire between July 1, 2009 and the end of the year. That is above and beyond the employees reflected by their June 1 payroll. They must keep this employee for at least 12 months, and at the end of that time, the business will be eligible for the credit. Credit is scalable, so if it is a part-time worker that's hired, they would get a percentage of the credit. I think the thing I like most about the Senate Bill 4, the way I understand it, and I'm not going to let you push me in detail questions because I don't have that kind of expertise, there aren't mounds of paperwork. You don't have a lot to have an army of accountants or lawyers. Any business owner can take advantage of it. It's my understanding what happens is the taxes you owe at the end, you simply subtract it from that. And that's how it works. That's as simple as that. If you owe this amount of taxes, you subtract it, and that's how it works. We're hoping that this piece of legislation does act as a piece of the puzzle which encourages businesses to begin hiring again, because I will freely admit to those in this committee be they Democrats or Republicans, government alone cannot solve the crisis we're in. There'll be some here might say they can't solve it at all. I happen to believe government does have a role to play in trying to deal with the crisis we're in. And we hope that employees they hire can help build their businesses in the communities that depend on these businesses. And we do have some amendments, apparently, that are coming forward. We'd limit it to a living wage jobs, limiting the number of times an employer can take the credit, limiting the employees eligible to only Oregonians, reducing 12-month requirement for employment to 6 months. This was at the suggestion of the Oregon Business Alliance, who we consulted about the bill and would allow businesses to begin taking the credit off their 2009 taxes. And I did forget that we actually did run this by OBA. Finally, an amount for the credit must be determined. So that's it. A simple bill. I understand the situations we're in. I did introduce it. It does appeal to me, but whether it will appeal to any member of this committee or the committee as a whole, I don't know. And I do not consider myself certified smart in incentives and credits and all that stuff that you are as individuals, members of this committee. I have never served on a revenue committee, and I would never serve on a revenue committee unless I was absolutely ordered to and had to. Because it's just not who I am, what I am. And
that's what happened to me, Mr. President.
I understand. So, but I do am grateful that you at least let me come and testify for the bill and that you'd even hold a public hearing on it this late in the session, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I brought Sasha Pollack, my policy advisor, with her because she knows exactly what the bill does and doesn't do. She helped craft it, and she knows many of the details. So,
thank you very much. Any questions from the committee for our president or Ms. Pollack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see, it's President the Sprinter Courtney. Am I correct?
You can just call me Flash.
In your conversations with business people, what was the sense of when you don't need to hire somebody? And you give them an incentive to, say, pay somebody 25% of their salary in the form of a tax credit. How do they justify the other 75% when there's actually no work for this person to do? Did they have a sense? I mean, I understand the incentive. You know, if the economy was growing, it might, you know, spark a little bit more. But when there's absolutely no work for them to do, feeling of having to be out of pocket the other 75%.
Chair Burdick, can I talk about, when I first discussed it several years ago, it was simply as an incentive to get young people to work in Eastern Oregon, and which people sometimes do in businesses, to hire young people over the summer, whether they really need them or not. I'm not saying they wouldn't need some work, but it's one of the ways that they like to show some goodwill. It was in that context. This context is, the idea is we're not trying to get people to hire people who they don't need. You know, they're good, they're smart business people. They still have a need. They know whether their businesses are in a crisis or not, but they're somewhat hesitant right now to bring people back or to bring new people on. And this could be the thing that they decided to make a chance, to take a chance on. That's the context in which they described it to me. But again, when it was first discussed years ago, it was simply, that's why I put it in here, as a way to hire college people on in the summer months, give them meaningful employment, and to give and make sure there's incentive for businesses to do that. But under this present situation, when we discussed it, it was that kind of situation that I just described to you. So there's two different discussions that went on over the last several years, and I talked about this to business types. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. President and Sasha, I don't think this is a technical question, but how do you know that these aren't jobs that would have been added anyway?
Well, Chair Burdick, Senator Rosenbaum, I don't know that. I guess the reason, my best response is, up until just last month, when it didn't level off. You get the impression it did when they said it stayed at 12.1, but then it actually was in 11. When you look at the unemployment and insurance numbers that we're looking at, particularly in rural Oregon, they're so staggering that I felt we had to look at this kind of program. I agree that we don't know for sure that they don't have to document that they would or would not have done that. So there is that risk here. So we don't know that. But I think when you're looking at these kind of unemployment numbers, there's a chance that this could be the incentive to get people to make the hire that they're hesitant to make. let's face it, I don't think people are simply going to hire people for this period of time unless they have a need, and unless they feel they need them for some reason. I don't think they're just... And also, I think that there's enough uncertainty out there, Senator Rosenbaum, in terms of the business people I'm talking to. They're reluctant to bring people on right now. They really are reluctant to hire new. In most sectors of the economy, it seems to me, the individuals I talk to and the reports and analysis I've seen both within the state as well as nationwide. And I think this, for most businesses far and away that did this, this could be the clinching factor to have them make that decision. That's just how I feel about it. But I cannot guarantee you there wouldn't be people they're going to hire anyway.
Would you like to follow Thank up? You. Just to follow up, so it doesn't appear that there's any threshold of wages or so any job, I mean a job paying minimum wage would qualify for this, I assume.
Currently the way the bill is, Senator, excuse me, Chair Burdick, manners are very important here. Manners, you got to have manners.
In West by God,
how you look, and very, you know, do you show well? It's very important. You may fail, but you must show well. Chair Bunny, Senator Rosenbaum. Currently, that's correct. We did talk about living wage in terms of an amendment, but currently, what you just said is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee, Senator Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Watch this. Did I miss something in this bill?
Well, here it goes.
There are blanks. Do we have a recommended amount of money, Mr. President?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, we first talked about the confines of my office, $10 million. But I didn't put that in the bill. It is in the bill? So what's it? The credit. No. That's part of the amendment. You're going to have to decide that. That's left up to your wisdom. That's what I just said. Finally, let me just read this to you. In my finally, an amount for the credit must be determined. So let's say we were spending $10 million in the program, which I don't know if we are, but let's say we were. You're going to decide what you think. I mean, in your wisdom, you're going to make that decision. I did not get into that, deliberately so, because I throw myself at the mercy and the expertise of this committee. See, that's the thing about me. I don't just bring you a bill. I bring you a bill and let you put your own, other people fill in everything. That's not what I'm about. I defer to your wisdom and expertise.
Now, if we can just get people to just bring us relating clauses, we'd all be happy. Any other questions? Thank you very much. This has been very enlightening, Mr. President. Thank you so much.
Sasha, did you want to Chair Burdick, I can give a little bit of background on what... for the record, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work in Senator Courtney's office. I just wanted to give a little bit of kind of how we got to this bill and perhaps answer a little bit of Senator Morse's question, because we did look a little bit at that and kind of weighed the options. We looked at a variety of bills from throughout the country, and Chris Alnack, who's sitting next to you, helped very much in kind of piecing those out for us. And this, our goal, the senator's goal, was to incentivize hiring people, adding to a payroll. So part of that, so that's, this is what we landed on. If you have $10 million to work with, you can, you know, do the math, how many jobs you want to create, or full-time equivalency, say you want to create 5,000 jobs, you do a $2,000 credit. You know, I'm sure that you will hear from business folks on whether or not that is sufficient to incentivize this, but as the senator so eloquently said, we thought of this not as the only piece in having someone hire a new position, but the tipping point on somebody who maybe does have a little bit more work than they can handle right now, is trying to make the decision on whether or not to hire or hire back. Maybe they've had their payroll get smaller over the last few years, but has gotten to a point now where things are picking up a little bit enough so that could this could be the extra piece that allows them to make that hire profitable.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, both of you, for coming. Senator Atkinson, are you here on this bill? Okay. Welcome to the committee, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Not staying for my brilliant testimony?
I hear him muttering as he leaves the room, so I don't know what that means.
For the record, Jason Atkinson, I represent Southern Oregon in Senate District Number 2. And I have my comments were made known to the president through a letter that that I sent his office, generally in support of the Senate bill, his Senate bill, and telling you that there's another bill that I've worked to craft, which is very similar in nature, which is House Bill 3493. And I will cover some of the things that are on that bill in case you want to move this forward. Feel free to loot and raid the other bill for some suggestive comments that might make this workable. And then secondly, you'll see a Dash 1 amendment that I'd like to introduce to you. The gist of the bill, it was just finished up by Sasha in stating that they looked around the country. Actually, a very similar measure like this was done in New Jersey, and it was somewhat successful. Successful on a couple of fronts. Number one, hiring within the state of people who are unemployed. Number two, having them be employed for a certain period of time. And number three, making sure that the credit was a fair amount to being able to cover someone for at least a month. So that was the incentive. Could the state afford to have somebody off of unemployment off of UI for a certain amount of time? And if so, could they cover? Would it be in the best interest of the state to keep that person employed if there's an opportunity to be employed for at least 6 months? What was that? The policy decision then was, what was that worth to the state? The difference between my measure and the work that we've done and the Senate president's is just a little bit on focus. Number one, Senate Bill 4 as drafted would allow someone to switch jobs, as I understand it, and receive the new employer to receive the credit. And that I don't think is, that might be an oversight. I don't think that's the direction we want to go. Number two, it also allows someone to be employed from another state who's unemployed, for an Oregon employer to hire someone from out of state. What I would suggest, what the bill I've worked on would do that I believe you should add to is, number one, make sure that we're hiring from people who have been unemployed for amount of time. In my bill, it's four weeks, someone, an Oregonian, who has been unemployed. And number two, someone who is about to be hired from an Oregon company or a company that has been domiciled in Oregon for at least 2 years. That way we start to narrow down the focus on exactly who would be able to receive this. Just given the nature of payroll and my experience, I believe that tax credit should be up to $3,000, which is about, for entry level and for hopefully the employment period, is a good balance of that thing I began to state, the scale that I led my comments off with. Scale on one side is the public policy benefit of having someone off of unemployment versus the cost. So in my bill, it says that person who qualifies has to be from Oregon, unemployed in Oregon for at least 4 weeks, to a company that's been in Oregon for at least 2 years, who does have the ability to hire and isn't fully employed for 1 year. And that's how, at least in my mind, in the way we drafted it, gets around to that benefit. Does it work? Do you hire somebody who's in your family? Do you go out and create a company and hire everybody in your family so you can load up on tax credits? No, because that gets around the two-year requirement, and also they actually have to be actively employed. So it does get around that element. Now, just real quickly to the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments are for your enjoyment. I was asked to introduce them as this type of a bill moves around. As of the last quarter, we had veterans from Afghanistan, the most recent conflict. The number in fourth quarter was 410 unemployed. The total amount of UI claims of veterans in Oregon right now is 26,158. And so the Dash 1 amendments would simply lift that ceiling that the President's bill has and apply that to any incentives possible for veterans. That is the gist of it. The policy decision is you know, there's a fundamental disbelief or belief, depending on your persuasion, in two political schools of thoughts regarding tax incentives, tax credits, and do they actually work. I'm of the camp that says if they're narrowly drawn, narrowly written, they can work. And so given that, that's the nature of where at least the policy I think should be employed is. And if this would move forward, just to send shrieks of horror down the halls of the Capitol, I would love to work with Senate President Courtney again to move something forward. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Atkinson. Any questions from the committee? Thank you for coming. Okay. We are going to now open a pub... Oh, dear. I forgot the sign-up sheet. Sorry, everybody. I didn't mean to scare you. Tom Gallagher and Marcia Kelly. Why don't we bring Bill Olson, too? We've got three people signed up and three chairs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing a number of businesses here, including Snitzer Steel and Oregon Auto Dealers. I'm not necessarily opposed to this bill, although I put that down. What I am is mostly frustrated with this, how this bill fits in with the rest of the tax policy here. I support the concept of increasing jobs. I thought that Chair Bragdon, or the chair of the Metro, when he was asked a couple of years ago about quality of life, and he made the comment that I thought was very profound, quality of life begins with a job. I think that whatever we can do here to increase employment in this recession is a good idea. I support what the Senate President has done in terms of his state stimulus plan, and I support transportation plan, both of which I think are going to provide some employment incentives here in the state. The issue I have here is there's a difference between jobs and new jobs. If we were simply adding to the roles of people who have already been employed, let me use an example, and I think Senator Rosenbaum kind of hinted at that. Using the cutoff date of June 2009, companies I represent, let's just use Snitzer, has laid off upwards of 70 employees prior to June of 79. I don't know what happens if they begin, as the economy changes, they begin to hire those employees back. Hiring employees off a layoff list, is that a new hire? Is that a return to work? If it is or it isn't, I think that's a problem either way that you go on it. The policy of making a decision to hire somebody to go to work usually is based on the economy. I have work here. I need to expand in this area. I need to have more people. I'm paying too much overtime. There's different decisions as to how you bring people back to work and how you get out of this recession. The frustration comes really with the recognition, is, as all of you have done, that the economic jobs disaster in Oregon, second in the nation, again, going back to the last recession when we began to lead the nation unemployment, something strikes here harder. I'm not an economist. I don't know what it is, but it strikes harder at the core here. At the same time, that businesses are laying people off, that they're doing operating cuts in their businesses. We're also looking at House Bill 3405, which will be a gross receipts tax on certain C corps and others that are not making a profit, that are going to have to take the money to pay the gross receipts out of their cash flow. Coming out of cash flow usually means has some effect on employees, which is the single easiest way to increase your cash flow without borrowing the money. So frustrated as we talk about using a gross receipts tax on the same businesses who are then laying people off and at the same time turning around giving a tax credit, perhaps, I think you'll fix that, but perhaps we're hiring that same employee back and keeping them there as long as the economy holds. So there's those two points. How do you figure out who gets this tax credit? I mean, I thought that there were some discussions of amendments that begin to narrow this down to a group of employees, whether it's veterans or Oregonians or this. Then creates a hiring problem. Do I hire this employee because I'll get a tax credit over this employee? That process, I think, makes a difference. Secondly, as you have a cap, there's a $10 million cap. I'm not quite sure if it's a three-year program, but the $10 million applies to the 3 years or applies annually. I think you'll have to sort your way through that. But how do you apply for it? Is it first come, first serve? Are there key strategic industries here that you want to support? The policy behind it of helping create jobs, I think, is a very good one. How this particular bill is going to work, it's out to target those jobs, and which jobs you target, I'm not so sure. So just let me end with that. I've had short discussions with all of my clients who are employers, and their point comes back is, why are we dealing with a tax credit right now? We have cuts coming in a tax credit, the business energy tax credit, which is one of the most well-used business credits right now. We've just gone through the pollution control tax credit, and now we're going to add a new higher credit. What's the philosophy behind this as it fits in with the rest of the tax bills and the way in which we balance the budget in this session? So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Well, okay. Let's move on. Welcome. Marcia?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, and I represent the American Association of University Women in Oregon. We have over 2,000 members in Oregon. I, like Tom, have some concerns about whether these jobs would be created already and whether we're just incenting jobs that might already be on the horizon. Given the fact that we're still using highway jobs in Connect Oregon, OTA projects, bridge projects, we have the big AARA transportation bill with jobs coming into the state, plus weatherization jobs, restoration jobs through the AARA. I think that incenting someone to create a job when there should be jobs on the horizon coming is not good tax policy, especially if you put that in light of what we're doing on the other side of the building with the budget and the major cuts that will be happening to programs where people are trying to get trained so that they can get jobs. And if you cut those training programs, then they're not going to be ready for the jobs that might possibly be created. I used to own a small business, and at $2,000, at $3,000, I would not go out and hire someone just to create a job to get that tax credit. I would have to have the work already before I would be committing myself to a job, because I would be paying unemployment taxes, I would be paying Social Security taxes, and in small businesses, it does not necessarily pencil out. And a lot of Oregon small businesses are having a hard time, but everyone in the country is having a hard time. And why should we continue with tax credits? I just added up this morning under the tax credits in House Bill 2067 that they're looking at different sunset dates on, it's $227,600,000 in environment, agriculture, and business. That's not all the tax credits. Those are just the ones that they've lumped together to look at that are Oregon tax credits.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm co-chair of the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. I also chair the Tax and Revenue Committee of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, so I guess I'm testifying on behalf of both. I want to raise what really is probably more a generic concern that applies pretty much across the board to tax credits in this environment, this biennium. And I'll just cite one example to pick up on Marcia's point about what is happening over in the Ways and Means part of our building. There's a proposal to cut the in-home care program in the Department of Human Services by a total of $18.9 million. That general fund portion of the program would leverage an additional $44 million in federal monies, which are going to be left on the table if that cut stands, for a total cut in that program of $63 million. Now, those are jobs, some of those home care workers are jobs that exist right now, and they're going to be laid off. So, again, we've got the juxtaposition of policy choices and priority choices. I'm not going to belabor the point. I think it's obvious. That's our testimony. We hope you'll very carefully consider weighing those priorities as you make your decision.
Thank you very much for coming. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. That ends our sign-up sheet. Is there anybody else who wants to speak on this? Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 4 and open a public hearing on House Bill 247. Do you have another one on here that we could take first? Do you have another one? We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2475. Welcome, Dave.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2475 extends cargo container property tax exemption to June 30, 2014. The exemption for these cargo containers has been in place since 1979. Current exemption sunsets on June 30, 2010. Exemption applies to containers owned by both domestic and foreign companies. Cargo container property tax exemptions are also granted in Washington and California.
Thank you very much. We have a panel, Rob Douglas, Ken Armstrong, and Dave Fiskin.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas. Here today representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association and the Maritime Fire and Safety Association. We urge you to pass House Bill 2475. As staff indicated, we have no knowledge of any Oregon jurisdiction ever levying any kind of tax on a cargo container, and we have no knowledge of any other port on the West Coast that has ever levied a tax on a cargo container. We feel to not extend the sunset would have a chilling effect on maritime commerce. And, Madam Chair, this comes at a time when year-to-date vessel traffic on the Columbia River system is down between 30 and 35%. We urge you to pass House Bill 2475.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your coming in with a sunset extension rather than a repeal of the sunset, given what this committee's preferences are on putting sunsets on everything. Thank you. Dave?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Dave Fiskum here for the Port of Portland with my colleagues supporting House Bill 2475 to achieve three objectives: to maintain our competitive position in international and global marketplaces, to avoid additional charges that might end up being unique to Oregon and put us in a competitive disadvantage, and to keep the incentive in place in what Mr. Douglas has described rightly as a down economy. So for all of those reasons, we're here in full support of House Bill 2475 and urge your favorable action. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Ken Armstrong representing the Oregon Public Ports Association. The Oregon Public Ports Association consists of all of Oregon's 23 public port districts, including, of course, the Port of Portland. And so I am here to express their support for 2475. Primarily impacts Port of Portland and then the upriver ports of Morrow and Umatilla, but the entire association is equally supportive of the legislation.
Thank you. And there's nobody signed up in opposition. Is your understanding that the counties are fine with this?
Madam Chair, I can't speak specifically for the counties. I don't know about any of the other panelists.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else?
All I was going to say, Madam Chair, is I don't believe there's any opposition. If there was, I suspect you'd hear it. So it's a consensus bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any
questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay, nobody else has signed up. Anybody want to talk on this? Nobody else. Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 2475. Open a work session on House Bill 2475.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2475 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2475 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Does anybody border on the Columbia River? I don't believe. I think Senator Rosenbaum, you're the closest. Would you like to carry
sure.
this? Okay. All right. Now we will open a public hearing on... Well, before we open our next public hearing, I want to let people know that I'm going to put over Senate Bill 621 until Thursday. So if anybody's here for that, we'll do that. Okay, we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2653. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2653 deals with the corporate apportionment formulas, and it removes an exception to the standard apportionment formula. As you're aware, the standard formula is a single sales factor, and the language that is getting removed in the bill is an exception that would allow for the use of double-weighted sales for forest product industry taxpayers that manage between 300,000 and 400,000 acres in Oregon and process at least 20% of their total wood chip supply for paper making from sawmill residue generated within Oregon. At the time this was enacted in 2003, the state was just moving to a single sales factor, and the anticipated effect was that this would have applied only to one taxpayer who has since reorganized, and currently we know of no taxpayers that this affects.
Well, that
that's kind of a cleanup.
That explains why we have nobody signed up. Senator Haas.
Thank you. Chris, if I recall, weren't unregulated utilities involved, wireless carriers, in terms of an exemption? Maybe Dr. Warner has some information.
Yeah, they are treated differently as well. There are for the single sales factor, there are a couple of exceptions. And the utilities are one of them.
Welcome, Dr. Warner. Not used to seeing you on that side of things here.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue. Senator Hassing, recalling there were some exceptions, the telecoms, as Chris pointed out. This was a particular one that came at the request of an individual company, and it was added literally in the last minutes of the... O3 session.
Thank you, if I may. What is the public policy reason for those being exempted?
Senator Haas, I think that the treatment was that they're an exception because they're kind of ubiquitous within the system as part of the infrastructure. I'm not sure if that particular rationale has been well worked out on the part of the committee. Again, that was something that came in when the sales factor was increased from 50 to 80%, and that was requested by the industry as to stay at the 50%, and it was granted by the legislature.
Let me follow up.
Please do.
I appreciate that industry wanting to exempt themselves. I mean, but it seems like there's a fairness issue here that if all of the other industries, have to play by this rule, then I don't know that it makes sense to exempt one industry that says, no, we want to keep the old system because it is to our advantage. Mm-hmm. So either everybody should go have that exemption or nobody should. So, Madam Chair, I guess I'm asking if we're going to move this, I'd like to at least have this committee consider an amendment that makes the rule apply to everyone.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Warner? Thank you for being our only witness. Anybody else want to speak now that you've heard some details? Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2653. And I think I'm supposed to move 832 and not even have the hearing. Is that correct, Paul? Okay, we're going to move Senate Bill 832 to what, Thursday? Will the amendment be ready by then? Okay. We'll move Senate Bill 832 to Thursday. And now we will open up a public hearing on, is that yours? On House Bill 3056. I think we're ready to go on that. That's the urban renewal, right?
Yes.
I mean, we're ready, aren't we?
I'm not sure what date. Mazin is looking for data right now.
Oh, okay.
You do have in your, Madam Chair, for 3056, there is a dash A8 in your packet.
Is this Mazin?
It's Days. Here comes Day.
Oh, okay. Where were you, Day? You're not allowed to leave. We move fast around here. Okay.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee. You will have dash eight amendment in front of you. Just received it a couple hours ago. Didn't have time to review all of them, but dash A7 was technical correction for House Bill 3056, and dash A8 is in principle eliminating gap bonds in calculation of consolidated billing rate. So that in terms of division of taxes, urban renewal plans get less money and give more to schools and other districts. That's the essence of dash A8 amendment. We are going to ask for a fiscal on dash A8, but because dash A8 arrived too late, we don't have the fiscal at this point.
Okay, so what I thought we would do, committee, is have a just hear what the dash A8s do. It is a long amendment. We have no fiscal, so we will be putting this over probably till Thursday. But I wanted to give Justin Martin a chance to go over the dash A8s. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of Portland Public Schools in full support of House Bill 3056 with the dash 8s, which I believe also include the dash 7s. We have, in communications with the county, the city, the PDC, and OSBA, asked to be a part of this because our gap levy is unique to the Portland Public School District. While we were represented by Oregon School Boards Association as part of the coalition, this unique part, the gap levy itself, is in there and does affect us. So what we are asking for with this amendment is, because it did not address that, the 2001 legislation creating new plan URAs did not address specifically Portland's gap authorization. We are here today to insert ourselves into this bill because we feel that the future financial impact might be greater, for example, if the city starts a new urban renewal area in the central city, with the exception that the 50 cents per thousand of assessed value would make a minimal difference in the financial projections. However, we feel that it would eventually add up to a significant benefit for local schools. So this amendment would allow all of us, the city, the school board, and the PDC alike, to let the community know that the new urban renewal area would have no direct impact on school funding. That's a large upside for all of us at very little financial impact to the city's revitalization efforts. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair, for considering this amendment, and please pass House Bill 3056 with the dash 8s.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? I'll have you up at a... Yeah, Ken, why don't you come up now and then...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ken Armstrong, wearing a different hat for the purposes of this bill, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and also the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, part of the group, the coalition that put together House Bill 3056, and comes before you in a unanimous sort of way, at least from the standpoint of the coalition. I just wanted to underline one of the things that Mr. Martin says, and that is that the Dash 8s include the Dash 7s, which we were before you last week describing in some level of detail. The Dash 8s are actually a very... the new part of it is a very that short paragraph, and we also have the attorney who drafted that for submission to legislative council here in the room. If there were any specific questions, the coalition does not have any problem with the amendments presented by Mr. Martin, and we'd encourage the committee to move the bill.
I appreciate that very much, and I want to again commend you for your work and being open to making this little tweak that is very important to Portland schools. Have you looked at the amendment to make sure that it accomplishes what you needed to in the Dash 7s?
Yes, I've scanned it, Madam Chair, to be sure that the same language in the 7s are in the 8s, and it appears that they are. I would also emphasize that I had a conversation with Mr. John Phillips, the Department of Revenue. He does not believe there's a revenue impact from the additional language in the Dash 8s, so we should be able to move this thing forward if the committee is comfortable with it.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you. I don't have anybody else signed up. Anybody else want to speak? Looks like Mr. Phillips wants to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips, Department of Revenue. Ken almost got it right. he said, I said there was no revenue impact, and I have not said that. I said there was no fiscal for the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
And I know you can't act on one anyone, but
just got to get your words right in this process. It's just so easy to mess them up.
Thank you.
Thank you for clearing the record up. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3056, and I'm going to carry it over till Thursday. And if there's something wrong with the A8 amendments, any technical glitches, we will move the bill out on Thursday with the Dash 7s. And take the issue over to the other side, so that we're starting to run out of time around here. And again, I want to commend all parties for their work on this. Thank you. Now we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 878. It's your show, Frank. Welcome back, Chris. We should have taken your bills in order.
It's okay. The exercise is good. Okay, Madam Chair, Senate Bill 878 would establish an Oregon new market development program and create a new market tax credit. What is new since the public hearing that from a couple weeks ago in your packet, you have a Dash 3 and a Dash 4 amendment. And the Dash 3 amendment does a couple things. In concept, it moves a lot of the oversight, if that's the right word, from the that certification process from the Department of Revenue to Economic and Community Development. And it also, in page 1, lines 19 through 24, they're deleted. And that is language that pertains to real estate projects for purposes of the credit. So it would allow those. The language excluded those types of projects.
Yes, sir.
That's essentially what the Dash 3 does. The Dash 4 fills in some blanks. The current bill on page 3, line 42, has a blank for the application fee. The Dash 4 makes that fee $5,000 and then also adds a $1,000 annual evaluation fee to the process and grants rulemaking authority to the department. The other key blank that's in the drafted bill is on page 4, line 41, for the total amount of credits to be issued under the program, and the Dash 4 sets that at $78 million, and the $78 million arrives from that corresponds to $200 million of investment for the program. So over the lifespan, of the credits, the 200, once the $200 million in investment is made, that translates into $78 million of credits taken over a number of years.
Okay. All right. We have Craig Campbell, Ryan Brennan signed up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Brennan with Advantage Capital Partners. Good to see you again here today. We are one of 250-plus what they call community development entities. These are entities reviewed and certified by the U.S. Department of Treasury to participate in the New Markets Tax Credit Program. This is a federal economic development program, currently $28 billion worth of investment capital targeted to rural and emerging urban low-income communities. This is probably the largest economic development program in place today at the federal level. This program has been very widely regarded now in its first 10 years, and some of the materials come out will show the New Markets Tax Credit Program again awarded a top 50 award by Harvard as Innovations in Government. It's been bipartisan at the federal level, and the structure is a 39% federal tax credit for investment in these low-income communities. That tax credit is spread out over a seven-year period. You invest the money up front into a business or, at the federal level, a qualified real estate project. The credit is taken over a seven-year period at a blend of 5 and 6%. That federal program, as I said, has been very widely regarded. The numbers are good. GAO has come back to say very good things about the program. Two things that are slightly inefficient. One is that the program's geographic distribution of the investment has been a bit lumpy, in that it is not given out or invested per capita by community or by state. Instead, it's all about where are the banks, where are the investors. All of us investors, 250-plus, apply and compete through Treasury for investment allocation amount. And then we will go out, all 250, and invest in their local home communities. States have found that because these investors are vetted and trained and have resources behind them, that it's an advantage having those investments and loans made to companies within that state. 4 years ago, states began looking at a way to attract those investments into their local communities. The state of Louisiana in 2003 put a match in place to say that if you invest your federal money, which you can invest anywhere in the country, in Louisiana, there will be an additional state-level credit. So all of the banks across the country then looked at Louisiana deals first. Several states have pioneered that model. Missouri, Illinois, Mississippi, and in the last several months, the states of Florida and then again Illinois have passed their own New Markets Tax Credit Program. So the bill that we have in front of us is a model after the Missouri Tax Credit Program that has had tremendous results thus far. This would attract $200 million of New Markets Tax Credit investment up to, and in exchange, an investor will earn a tax credit spread over 7 years, but the first credit being earned in the third year if the money remains in that qualified business within the low-income community. Should that investment fail and pay back early, the credit is recaptured by the state of Oregon. Should the company move outside of the low-income census tract, the credit is recaptured by the state of Oregon, and not just the credits going forward, but the entire 7 years' worth of credits. So we ask for your consideration for this program here. It has good early results. It's modeled after a very strong federal program, and some of the results for a prospective analysis that we've done show that can be quite powerful in getting money to these companies that are truly dying on the vine looking for capital today and help those companies add jobs and employ people.
Is Louisiana's credit a 39%? How big is that credit?
Madam Chair, it is a 25% credit, but it's taken over the first 2 years. So some credits, Mississippi and Louisiana, have lower nominal credits, but they're taken up front. So the present value is all relatively close. A tax credit buyer, so to speak, or a bank who would use this credit as a vehicle or an incentive to make this investment would say that a 39% credit over 7 years is about 24 cents in present value. So the Louisiana credit, although structured differently, is about the same present value credit.
And so when you add the federal credit, where are you in terms of having the cost of the project offset by credits?
Spread over the 7 years, about 40 cents, 40 to 42 cents.
42%?
Yes, ma'am.
So help me with my math here. Does that mean, what is the federal credit? Just state credit aside, what is the federal credit?
The federal credit is also 39%, so it's a nominal 78% credit. The state tax credit, when taken at about a 25-cent value, will offer about 20% to the bottom line of the investment made. State credits are worth a little bit less because you lose a federal tax deduction if you pay less in your state taxes. And then the federal credits right now are giving about 22 cents of value for that 39% federal credit.
Okay, so you're to make this pencil out, you assume that you transfer the credits.
All of the credits have to stay within the investment structure. Tax credit buyers or users are brought into the investment early into the process, so they have to participate in the deal. The credits cannot be sold to an unaffiliated third party after the investment is made.
And that's the part that confuses me a little bit in terms of how that works. Because my concern with some of these credits is the business only gets 65 cents on the dollar, roughly, of benefit, and yet the state general fund gets hit for the whole amount of the credit, and that's what you get when you transfer credits.
And this program has almost specifically restricted those types of transfers or transactions outside of the investment. Very often, the bank itself, U.S. Bank, Bank of America, KeyBank, these are all very large participants, will be both a lender into that small company, and they will ultimately use the tax credits. So part of the efficiency, I think, of the federal structure and what we've seen in Missouri and Louisiana thus far is that since all those investors or people contributing capital are in the structure at the very beginning, that you don't have 2, 3, 4, 5 levels of transfer of that tax credit where everybody needs to take 3 to 5% of a fee. So the maximum value of that tax credit generally flows to the company itself. And when companies like ours go back to Treasury next year and apply for their 5th round, 6th round, we have to justify how much of the value of the credit has been shared with the small business itself. And we are evaluated on how much of that benefit passes down to the company.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you. Did you want to add something, Craig?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Advantage Capital as well. I just wanted to take a brief moment and talk a little bit about the potential benefits that come to the state of Oregon as a result of the bill that we have in front of us. Mr. Brennan alluded to the fact that right now small businesses that want to expand, and as the economy starts to turn around, the challenge that small businesses are going to have is their ability to access credit so that they can grow when the economy starts to turn around, is that it's just not available right now for many small businesses. Traditional bank loans are not available. The credit that is in front of you, there's a requirement prior to them being eligible for the credit is they must be turned down for traditional bank loans. That's the norm rather than the exception now. And so this provides a layer of revenues that would be available to them by way of loans that will allow them to expand at a time that they wouldn't be able to get other resources. In effect, by putting this in place, you are bringing resources into the state to grow the economy that would not otherwise be available. Certainly, there's going to be some level of the federal tax credit that may be available to the state of Oregon, but this would bring in far more dollars than would otherwise be available to grow the economy. We're anticipating that directly this bill will create about 3,000 jobs, and with follow-on investments that often come with these investments, as high as 6,000 additional jobs over the next 7 years. Some of those will certainly be new jobs. Many of them will be jobs that would otherwise be lost as businesses go out of business because they're unable to get resources to continue to keep their doors open. So this is a it's the right time for this bill because of that reason. It provides much needed resources at a time that otherwise wouldn't be available.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Was the 3,000 jobs statistic, was that direct jobs or did that include all the indirect?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, that's the direct job. The number that added the indirect was around 6,000. I think it's 6,060 jobs was anticipated as a result of both direct and indirect. And I believe that also includes construction jobs, so that's included in the number.
So the construction jobs would not be permanent jobs?
Madam Chair, no. And that, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, I think that constituted around 350 jobs. The information that was used to generate that has been provided to you, and I'll get that specific number. It was a relatively small amount of jobs that would not be long-term, and that would be for physical expansions of businesses and things along those lines that would result as businesses expand.
And what type of jobs are these in general? Are these family wage, full benefit kind of jobs, or are they lesser?
They have been family wage, and that was part of the research done in Missouri. 100% of the jobs created there in a year and a half, and they have about 1,760 jobs created to date. Those are direct jobs. And 100% of those have benefits associated with them, and the average wage is about $32,000.
Madam Chair, and I'll follow up with that. One of the things that we've placed in the bill with the Dash 3 amendments is a requirement that any of those that are allocated funds for investment have to keep track of the number of jobs that are created with those investments, the average salary of those investments, and they have to report back on the percentage of those jobs that carry with them health benefits so that that can get reported back to the legislature so you can track the progress of the proposal.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification on the risk and benefit sheet. The first paragraph, if the company receiving eligible investment funds fails and repays the loan or leaves the state gets all of the tax credit money back from the investor. The word fails and repays, it's a little incongruent. Could you offer some
certainly
explanation?
And a little bit on that paragraph. Part of what looks like a successful portfolio, I think, through New Markets Program is that the companies that have received investment have held that investment for the seven-year period, and they have paid their coupon or interest on that over 7 years. Although we have not had this situation yet in our 6 years working through the New Markets Program, if a company were to, say, borrow $100,000 through the program and they repay $100,000 of it in the first year, we have a choice of either losing credits and our investors lose credits on that money or making a replacement investment. If the company in the fourth year repays $50,000 of the investment, we're required to reinvest the $50,000. Whatever is repaid, the other portion is lost. And there are no credits recaptured on that amount, but it's the portion that comes back in principal that we are no longer earning interest on that we have to replace into a new investment or lose future credits.
So once that happens, to follow up on Senator Morse's question, how is the new investment judged? I mean, is this just at your discretion?
Chair Burdick, it has to be also a qualified investment, so it has to fit all the same characteristics as the law in general. It's, in essence, like making a new investment, although you receive no new credits for it. So you have to make a replacement investment. If Company A pays back a portion of the loan, you have to take that amount, find a Company B that also qualifies under the New Markets law, and make a replacement investment within a year.
Senator Morris, did that answer your question?
Well, it's still, I'm a little perplexed. If the company receiving the benefits fails,
okay.
goes out of business.
Okay.
And then the statement, and repays the loan. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just a language wording.
What if they fail and don't repay the loan? Isn't that what you're getting at?
Yeah. I think that's what you're asking. Yeah. Sorry, and let me clarify. Some of that is probably our portfolio speak of how we view the successful or unsuccessful portfolio. If a company fails and comes to us in the third year or fifth year and says, we've used all your money and we have no collateral, and we can't repay the loan, we lose that entire amount, and there is no recapture of the credits. If the company comes in the fifth year and says, we have spent that $100,000, and here's our collateral that we originally told you that we would put up on day one of the loan, we liquidate that collateral for $80,000, then that's the amount of money that needs to be reinvested through the program. Sometimes when we use the word fail, to us, that means that this company is no longer paying interest on a note that we've issued. If the company fails and there's no collateral, which we've never had happen, but certainly, I guess, could be possible, then we are out that investment amount, and then there's no recapture of credits. But if any money is brought back into the fund, which we hope either is done because the company has a full investment or there's collateral to liquidate, any money recovered has to be reinvested through the program or credits can be recaptured.
Recaptured by whom? By the state?
Yes, ma'am.
So basically, if the company just out and out fails, the state loses the credits?
Yes, Chair. If it out and out fails and there is zero collateral or no other way for the fund to recapture any of its investment, yes, ma'am, then it would, the state would be out its investment and the private investors would be out their investment.
That was not your understanding, was it?
No, it was a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. other questions? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What kind of statistics do we have on rates of failure where states have not been made whole on their credits?
To my knowledge to date, there have been no companies that have failed through the state programs. Louisiana, Mississippi, and Missouri are the ones with the longest track record. And I'll get those exact numbers for you. In our portfolios, we have seen no failures, and I do not believe there have been any in those portfolios, but I will clarify that. And I guess to expand on that, generally these investments, I think the reason one might say, how can there be no loan losses in a portfolio in the times that we're going through, I think it's twofold. One is that for the investments that have been made, the loans that have been made to these companies, there's a very strict underwriting process, but we've seen that across the board. All of our companies have either existed on the money that they have borrowed or been invested, but have sometimes come back for follow-on investment or have said we need additional capital to expand the business or to keep it operating. That's a role that Advantage Capital, I know many other investors play. So, you know, we've been very pleased with the portfolio, and I think that that speaks to the type of credits and the investment firms that are in the business.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the process that these companies go through just to become allocatees is a fairly exhaustive process where their judgment and investment is put to the table. My understanding is the application at the federal level is a close to 1,000-page document. When they are making their determination as to how they invest these monies that are eligible for the state and federal tax credits, they go through a pretty tremendous amount of vetting as before they're willing to loan to a business to avoid a situation where there would be a failure, because these people, believe it or not, the allocatees actually are businesses they are in to make money off of the investments. They don't make a huge amount, but they do make enough to make it worth their while to make sure that the investment is going to return. The last thing they want to have happen is a business to fail underneath them, because that is entire loss. There's no profit. The initial investment is lost. So one of two things occurs. One, well, both of two things occurs. One is before they make the investment, they make sure it's a sound investment. And if things are starting to look bad, they make sure that they step in. Oftentimes they own a portion of the business as an arrangement for the loans. They step in to make sure that the business doesn't fail, because if it fails, then they lose their money. So they become a very good advocate on behalf of the state in making sure that those businesses don't ultimately fail.
Thank you. Other questions?
Well, just as a follow-up,
yes,
maybe review again the circumstances by which the state would recapture the tax credit. Just go through that again, if you would, please.
Yes, sir. Perhaps use a $100,000 investment or loan as an example. If a company were to come to a participant in the Oregon program and were to say, I've been turned down by banks, I'd like to access this capital, Advantage Capital may make a $100,000 loan to that company. The cases in which the state will recapture their investment is if the company were to, in year four, come in and say, we no longer want to be in this low-income census tract. We want to move to the state of Washington, or we want to move to a relatively wealthy suburb. That company at that point would have to pay back their loan to Advantage Capital, and we would either have to make a replacement investment into a new company, or the state of Oregon recaptures that tax credit. Possibility two is if the company comes to us in year two and says, we just don't need the money anymore. We have adequate sales. We don't need the capital. We're going to pay it back to you in year two, and we'll pay you a little extra interest. The CDE or Advantage Capital has a year from that point to make a replacement investment for the remainder of the 7 years. Company comes to us in year three and says, times are really tough. It just hasn't worked for us. This product doesn't really have a market. We have this machinery that we put up as collateral. Out of the $100,000, we can pay you $20,000, and we think our machinery is worth $80,000. So collectively, we recover the $100,000. Again, we have a year to replace the capital. If the company says we have zero and we have machinery worth $50,000, same scenario, we have a year to replace the $50,000. If a company comes to us and says we have no money, we have no product, and all the collateral that we pledged to you has zero value, then Advantage Capital loses their $100,000 investment, and then there is no recapture by the state of Oregon. If at any of those points when the CDE has a responsibility to reinvest any money, fees, collateral recovered, cash paid back, if at any point we don't make a replacement investment, the state of Oregon not just foregoes any prospective tax credits, but must be paid back by Advantage or the tax credit users any amount that was taken previously.
Thank you.
Okay, so when they let's say that you know, the company just goes belly up and has no collateral.
Yes, sir.
Say in year four, are these tax credits, they're taken over 7 years, but are they allocated all at the front end?
They are. When the money goes into the company up front, that's when the credit clock starts ticking, so to speak. Yes, Senator, is that if you invest that $100,000 up front, we want that company or a company like it to have use of that money for a seven-year period. So the design is credit won't begin until year three, so that company can frankly pay more taxes over a few years before the state has any liability to the credit, and then that credit will be taken in years 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
But if the company goes out of business in year 4, does the state lose all 7 years of the credit, or just the 3 years remaining?
For any amount that the company is unable to pay back and can't be reinvested, once that money is invested into the company, then that will be foregone revenue from the state of Oregon. And then it becomes the responsibility of the CDE or Advantage Capital to make sure that money stays in eligible companies unless it is lost with absolutely no money they can come back.
Madam Chair, clarification. You're asking that if a company goes out of business in year four, does somebody get to take the credit in year 5, 6, and 7? Is that what you're asking?
All I care about is whether the state is out that money.
Right, for year 5, 6, and 7.
Yes.
So, yes, so they are. They are.
Okay. All right. Other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Jack Isselman.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Isselman. I appear before you today on behalf of Portland Family of Funds and its affiliate, United Fund Advisors. And as you may recall, both Portland Family of Funds and United Fund Advisors are national companies based in Oregon. We are among the most experienced and effective new market tax credit programs in the country. And we urge your adoption of Senate Bill 878 with the dash 3 and the dash 4 amendments. As legislative revenue staff indicated, the dash 3 amendments would allow real estate projects that are the emphasis of our portfolio to participate in the state new market tax credit. And we believe the broadest and most efficient use of the program will develop the best results. And that, we believe, would be the creation of a program that focuses on producing jobs, whether through a direct business investment or a real estate-focused investment. And let me make clear at the outset, the generation of jobs and the creation of businesses is the key driver for any allocatee under the new market tax credit system. You need to demonstrate that to the Department of Treasury before you receive an allocation. Significant job creation and community impacts, we believe, are best achieved with the broadest range of investment options. And to that end, we commend you to the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments. A study by the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco indicated that 62% of all new market tax credit programs in the country used the real estate investment model, and the real estate investment model of that 62% accounted for 84% of the employment of all jobs generated by the new market tax credit investment. And I've given you a sheet here that details 10 Portland area projects that we've been involved in using new market tax credit financing, which demonstrates the total project investments, the credits that helped leverage that investment, and then the construction jobs and permanent jobs created. The bottom line being a total fiscal impact over the 10 years estimated at $31 million to the state of Oregon. We also, when we appeared before you in March or April, we were asked about community impacts. And so we brought back to you today our community impact measurement system that's been in place since we were first received an allocation of credits. And you'll see we monitor various measures closely, income-related measures to ensure that we are creating the type of high-wage, family-wage jobs that this committee would want to see, wealth creation measures. In our particular portfolio emphasis, environmental return measures are important. We emphasize the use of LEED certification and green building projects. We also measure transit trips that are generated by the new market tax credits and broader quality of life issues as it relates to environmental return. Then we also measure indirect community impacts, broader business impacts, and impacts to the residents in the census tracts where we invest. I also brought, just for your reference, a community benefits agreement. This is part of every transaction that we enter. And among other things, is it stipulates that we will do a community benefits review each year. So we're closely monitoring our portfolio investments, not only for, obviously, the return they're creating for us and our investors, but also for the broader benefits that they're achieving for the community. This is important because at the federal level, the Department of Treasury wants to see that type of community impact, and we know if we're going to be successful in future allocations, and we've submitted applications for future allocations, that we need to demonstrate this community impact time and again. We've had a high degree of success with the federal program, and the federal program itself, as the prior witnesses told you, has achieved a great amount of success and support to the degree that it has received an additional $1.5 billion of allocation in this current round. So with that, I can close on my prepared remarks and answer any specific questions you might have that were not addressed by the previous panel.
Jack, one of the projects that the Portland Family of Funds has used New Market tax credits for is the Nines, and that's struggling financially now. So maybe you could use that as a case study to let us know what will happen to the, in this case, it's the federal government, but what will, who will be out money if that goes down?
Well, and I have gone back and asked my client about that project, and I can't offer as many specifics as they can, obviously, being part of the transaction. But what they've conveyed to me, basically, the developer, first and foremost, is the one who is front and center in terms of the costs of the loss coming back. Now, the tax credits right now have not been impacted one way or another. What has occurred on that transaction, my understanding is there's been an extension of the loan repayment terms on a separate note issued by the Portland Development Commission that I think is related to the status of that particular project in an urban renewal area. So to the degree you're reading about adjustments in that transaction, the New Market tax credit component of that has yet to be affected. Obviously, the Portland Development Commission has an interest in allowing that loan to continue to be a performing loan to keep the hotel open. What you've seen there, I think, is a traditional use of urban development dollars to revitalize a dilapidated and decaying structure that was probably approaching condemnation. So we've got a great community asset there. The struggle, obviously, is it's been launched in a time of a great economic uncertainty and certainly diminishing discretionary spending. So the hope is that with an extension on the loan terms to the developer, that will allow adequate time for the project to perform, for market conditions to approve, for the project to perform. And the credits and the urban renewal loan to ultimately be proved to be a good investment. And it's important to bear in mind that we, along with those who do direct investments in business, take a portfolio approach here. So not every transaction will perform as well as the next transaction, but the goal is to create a portfolio of transactions that performs and outperforms the amount of investment that's coming in through credits or reduced interest rates on loans and the like.
Thank you. Question, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this was addressed and I just missed it, but the bill is effective on the 91st day sine die. When would we see capital starting to accumulate and invest?
It may be a better question for Mr. Brennan, because I know there's the federal government is going through its allocation process now. So I think that the next key step is whenever the federal government issues that next allocation, because I think if you don't have those allocations, then you can't apply for the state tax credit. I'm not sure of the timing. I haven't asked my
client. Why don't we bring those folks back up and to answer that question? That's a good question, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ryan Brennan with Advantage Capital. To understand your question, how quickly will the capital flow should this become law? I think Missouri saw about 120 days after the law became effective that the first investments were being made. The entire $175 million in their program was invested in about the 6 months after the first investment was made. Part of the benefit is that this structure, although strange, is now known by investors and can move very quickly. You might also expect there's a lot of pent-up demand for the capital. So I would expect you'd see, at worst, first investments before the end of 2009 and likely
the entire $200 million invested before the end of 2010.
Actually, the bill, Chris was just pointing out, it says it applies to qualified equity investments made on or after January 1st, 2010.
Oh, 2010. Okay.
Oh,
so after that effective date, you're saying that timeline would start?
Yes, Senator. Madam Chair, I think that you would see that that time would be taken, certainly, to come up with the structure of the program, and then I think you'd see the money move quickly.
So, and the point of the question was the timing of money going to work and the tax credit lagging is a benefit in this biennium.
Right.
Yes.
Certainly.
And as you know, the credit is
coming
not,
biennium, I mean.
Madam Chair, Senator, the credit is not a hard date you get to begin with taking a tax credit. It's all cued off of when the money goes to the company. Then the clock, that 3-year clock begins at that point.
The 3 years before you get
the first credit.
Credit.
Yes, Senator.
Okay, but during that 3 years, it's all private money.
Yes, ma'am.
How does is that the way the federal credit works as well?
The federal credit begins the moment that you make the investment. So it's 5% and then 6% to come up with your 39%. Part of the I think discretion at Missouri and others have followed the model is to make sure that there's a few year of new general revenues collected before the first tax credit is used.
So basically, and how long does the federal credit last?
It's also a 7-year tax credit.
So it overlaps, and years 3 and 4 and 5, you've got both of them gone.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, interesting stuff.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to, anybody else want to talk on this? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 878, and I think we're ready on that one, aren't we? Let's see, who's this at? Okay, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2107. Welcome,
Mazin. Afternoon, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2107, we've been waiting on its paperwork for a few days. Just to remind you of the bill, this is the bill from the MDEC, the Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, and most of the original bill does the general cleanup and reauthorization and redrafting of some of the investment laws. And then you have the Dash 2 amendments. Those are the ones that we did not have fiscal impact on. And the Dash 2 amendments allow for the school boards, I believe, and local governments to issue bonds. And at that time, the Department of Revenue took some time to examine those and their impact on local budgets. And we waited for the fiscal impact, and we finally happy to report that we have response from the counties. Senator Telfer, you were interested in the county's response last time, and the county's response that they do not have a fiscal impact from the bill. So in that sense, also, the bill to the state is no fiscal impact.
Okay. Let's see. I've lost my paperwork on this.
So you have the Dash 2 amendment.
Yeah, I'm just trying to look for them. I've got so much stuff floating around up here. Let's see. Let me put it in here. There we go. Okay. Does anybody in the audience want to add anything on the Dash 2s? Okay. Mazin, you've looked them over. We've got the fiscal, we got the revenue. We got everything we need, right, Madison?
Yes.
Okay. A motion, Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2107.
Senator Morris has moved the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill or House Bill 2107. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2107 as amended to the floor with a defense recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 2107 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who knows the most about this subject? I bet Senator Telfer does.
Well, I will.
We'll have Senator Telfer carry this. Committee, that completes our agenda for today, and we will meet again tomorrow. We are adjourned.